the value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Welcome to the Investor Download, the podcast about the themes driving markets and the economy now and in the future. I'm your host, David Brett. Elon Musk, the founder of Tesla, might have been bombastic when he offered to end world food poverty by selling shares in his company.
Tesla and SpaceX CEO Elon Musk says he's willing to sell Tesla stock if the United Nations official, who said that just 2% of the entrepreneur's income could help solve world hunger, can back up the claim. In a tweet on Sunday, October 31st, Musk said, "If WFP can describe on this Twitter thread exactly how $6 billion will solve world hunger, I will sell Tesla stock right now and do it."
But it trivialized a very real issue. We're facing a crisis, and it's not just in food, it's in water too. And it's not just a third world problem.
Between 2010 and 2050, we're going to have to increase the amount of food and water that's being produced by about 70%. So just for a bit of context, that actually involves producing more food and water over the next 30 years than we have over 5,000 years of human history.
That's Felix Odie, a fund manager at Schroders. And he says the $6 billion Elon Musk was offering is just the tip of the iceberg.
Across the whole system in food and water, it's estimated that around $30 trillion needs to be spent.
Which will bring with it investment opportunities as the world rises to the challenge facing the food and water system.
What we're seeing is a lot of these companies go from effectively low growth rate companies to higher growth rate companies. But at the same time, at the moment, they have very much a value bias.
That's fund manager Mark Lacey. We'll hear more from Mark later in the show. But before we get to how investors access the opportunities that solving the food and water crisis presents, Felix is going to help us to understand why there is a crisis in the first place, what needs to be done to help solve it, and how investors will play their part.
Get in touch with us by email at schrodespodcasts@schroders.com or visit our website, schroders.com/investor download.
We're told we're facing a food and water crisis. But what do people actually mean?
So really, I think there's two parts to this crisis. So the first is really around food and water security. So this is the idea that actually, you know, between 2010 and 2050, we're going to have to increase the amount of food and water that's being produced by about 70%. So just for a bit of context, that actually involves producing more food and water over the next 30 years than we have over 5,000 years of human history. The second part of the crisis, it relates to the kind of sustainability of the overall system. And really, when we look at the system today, in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, in terms of its water intensity, the biodiversity loss it's caused, and also the physical pollution and waste it's caused, it's just not sustainable.
The United Nations has concluded that factory farming is one of the biggest contributors to the most serious environmental problems at every level, from local to global. Land degradation, climate change, pollution, water shortages, habitat destruction, these are not inevitable.
So, I mean, let's take water as an example. And, you know, I think one of the things that's not fully understood by a lot of people is that actually if we're going to solve the water problem, we need to solve the water in agriculture problem. And that's because agriculture accounts for about 65% of all freshwater usage. And, you know, a stat that astounded me was at the moment the world uses around 4 trillion cubic meters each year of water. That's the equivalent of about 1.6 billion Olympic swimming pools. But actually, that is just one part of the picture. As I mentioned, you know, biodiversity loss has only accelerated in the past 30 years. We've actually cut down globally around 1.3 million square kilometers of forest since 1990. That's about the size of South Africa. So an absolutely huge impact, given that about 80% of all terrestrial species actually live in forests.
And it's not just how we produce the food that's causing problems. It's the waste that results from it too.
I think, you know, we're all familiar with certain images that are very emotive on this. And, you know, we've seen the kind of, rivers of sewage in parts of the world like Bangladesh and India that are a consequence of this.
The Yamuna River in North India begins high up in the Himalayas.
Yamuna is basically filled by the human activities. In this water, heavy metals, toxic metals, pesticides, all are present.
Oxygen levels in parts of the river are zero. No animal life can be sustained. But human life on the river continues.
And again, you know, things like the Great Pacific Garbage Patch are already bigger than France, Germany and Spain combined, and they're only growing. At the moment, we produce around 2 billion tonnes of waste each year. Only a fraction of that actually gets recycled at the moment. And this is really why we think that when you're looking at the food and water system, given about 60% of all waste, be that, you know, plastics or packaging or the physical food waste, actually relates to food and water. Again, this is something that we really need to get right. And this is why the circular economy is so important to this value chain.
Living systems have been around for a few billion years and will be around for many more. In the living world, there's no landfill. Instead, material flow. One species' waste is another's food. Energy is provided by the sun. Things grow, then die, and nutrients return to the soil safely. And it works. Yet as humans, we've adopted a linear approach. We take, we make, and we dispose. Each time we do this, we're eating into a finite supply of resources and often producing toxic waste. It simply can't work long term. So what can? If we accept that the living world's cyclical model works, can we change our way of thinking so that we too operate a circular economy?
While we appear to have an aversion to adopting the circular economy, ironically, the linear economy is coming back to bite us. A byproduct is that it's causing a health crisis.
This is almost a third part of the crisis. When we talk about health, there's really a couple of different elements that relate to this. And the first is obviously malnourishment and obesity. So this is really just the misallocation of food globally. And you know, the very depressing thing really is that since 1975, the number of obese people globally has tripled to around 2 billion adults at the moment.
More people around the world are overweight than ever before, and not a single country is succeeding in tackling the problem. The stark findings, published in the medical journal The Lancet, blamed a lack of this. Not enough exercise and easy access to cheap fatty food is fueling the problem. The study found...
we've still got 800 million people globally who are malnourished. So, you know, these extremes in weight, these extremes in food allocation are a massive problem that we need to overcome. But actually, it goes beyond that because, you know, if we look at diet-related illnesses, I mean, I think people are a lot more aware now of the burden that that things like diabetes and obesity-related illnesses are having on the National Health Service. But to put a few stats around it, at the the last major study in the UK for this was done in 2015, and it was estimated that around about £10 billion a year is being spent on kind of obesity and diabetes-related health issues, which is actually more than the police, fire service and judicial systems combined. It's a massive burden on even today, and it's only set to get worse. So it is a massive problem that we also need to overcome. And really, this is where the consumer is going to drive this change.
But as consumers, we've proven to be stubborn customers, unwilling to give up those cheap, unhealthy options, despite knowing it will save our health and ultimately our finances in the long term. Our choices have also had a major impact on agriculture and the way farmers farm their land and manage their cattle.
You know, when we look at agriculture, it's both sides of the equation, right? Because at the moment, the agricultural system accounts for around about a quarter of all greenhouse gas emissions, but it also has massive potential to try and offset those greenhouse gas emissions globally. I think things like regenerative farming, forestry for carbon sequestration is gaining a lot more visibility in the public press.
All over the world, farmers are developing an alternative system to regenerate soil instead of degrading it. to protect and increase water retention by covering soil with mulch and by growing continuous diverse crops without tilling or ploughing. It's called regenerative agriculture, which includes no-till farming.
But actually, we're only at the beginning of this. So there's massive opportunity, and you know, there's a lot of companies out there that are doing very exciting things to try and decarbonize some of the most carbon-intensive parts of the chain, be that in fertilizers using more green hydrogen, or things like, you know, alternative and fake meats, given around about almost 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions in the food and water system actually relate to meats.
More of that in a bit. But you might be wondering, given the impact that producing food and water has on the atmosphere in terms of emissions, oceans and rivers in terms of pollution, and agriculture in terms of arid and unusable land, how on earth did we let the situation get to where it is today?
There's actually been a study done recently by the UN in combination with IHS, which estimates that at the moment we spend about $9 trillion on food and water globally each year. But actually the environmental costs and the cost of human health add up to around about $19 trillion. So actually the externalities that are not being captured in the price that we pay for food far outweigh the price that we currently pay. So I think it is that the fact that people haven't had to take responsibility. I also think it's partly a short-termism. It's a short-termism from governments, from producers, but also consumers. We know that people are very sensitive to food inflation, and the idea of paying more for food is a very difficult concept. So ultimately, I think what we've seen is a system that is incentivizing near-term yield gains that are long-term going to actually be detrimental to our ability to produce food. That is a classic market failure, and it's one that we are going to have to pay for at some point.
A failure exacerbated by a ballooning global population.
This isn't the first time that we've seen populations grow quickly. This isn't the first agricultural revolution that we've gone through. But I think the difference last time was that as populations grew, we could just expand the frontiers of agriculture. We could expand the amount of land that we were using, whereas that's no longer an option. And if anything, we actually need to reforest about 70 million hectares over the next 30 years. You know, this problem isn't going away, and populations aren't going to stop growing. The UN estimates that, you know, the population will reach around 10 billion by 2050. And that's really why it goes back to my original point on why this is a two-part crisis. The first part is that we are going to have to produce a lot more food, and we're going to have to do it whilst using a lot less resources.
And if it's not tackled now?
You know, we've mentioned on health, we've mentioned the current cost. That is only set to grow exponentially if we don't start changing our diets. And likewise, if we don't start changing the system now, we're going to start seeing yields actually declining. You know, it's estimated that at a 2-degree scenario, the yields on corn globally are going to drop by about 20%.
2-degree scenario. This refers to temperatures rising to 2 degrees above the pre-industrial revolution average, and still above the 1.5-degree limit agreed at the Paris Climate Conference in 2015.
So given that governments already spend around about $720 billion a year subsidising food, what we're going to end up seeing is just this capital drain, this kind of money drain from governments as they have to spend more just to stay in the same place, be that on health or be that because of declining yields. So there's a lot of reasons why it's much better and much more capitally efficient to act now than it is to wait until this goes from being a problem to being a complete crisis. It's not just emissions, it's not just health, it's water as well. I've mentioned the kind of water intensity that's quadrupled over the past 40 years, but there's a lot of major aquifers in California and other parts of the world that are key to the agricultural system.
Aquifers are water-bearing rocks which can stream water to wells and springs and be used to naturally irrigate land.
That if they run out, it will take over 5,000 years for them to replenish. So really, this is something that you know, if we don't start dealing with very soon, is going to have very real-world impacts, both in terms of the deaths caused, in terms of the price of food, and in terms of health as well.
A potentially bleak future awaits unless we invest and adapt right now. But what needs to change to ward off a catastrophe? And what are the opportunities that presents? That's coming up in part two.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
So we now understand more about the crisis facing the food and water system. But what changes do we need to see to ward off a potential catastrophe?
I mean, when we think about the kind of structural changes that this system needs, we really break it down into three parts. And the first is that we need to increase efficiency. So we need to increase agricultural yields. The second is that we need to change diets and eating patterns. And the final one is that we need to actually create a system that is actually producing less physical waste and emissions. And actually, we see kind of three almost separate but entwined drivers of these. So, you know, when we're talking about yields and efficiency, that's going to be technology. And actually, what we have this time versus previous agricultural revolutions is data.
So it's like the green revolution problem all over again. How do we get to this significant increase in food production? The agricultural scientists have been thinking about this problem for quite a while, and the most promising approach right now seems to be that of data-driven farming. What we mean by data-driven farming is the ability to map every farm in the world and overlay it with lots and lots of data. For example, what is my soil moisture level 6 inches below the soil throughout the farm? What is my soil nutrient level throughout the farm? If you could build maps like this, this could enable techniques like precision agriculture.
And I can't overestimate the importance that data is going to play, because it just means that at the moment we're dealing with a very analog system. It results in a lot of waste throughout the system. And actually, by having data, we can actually become a lot more predictive in how we apply agricultural inputs, in how we protect crops, in how we stop waste before it actually occurs. Likewise, the change in diet and eating patterns, what we've already seen is that we currently globally have a very suboptimal diet. We eat far too much red meat and animal meats in general, and not enough legumes, vegetables and fruits. By actually shifting that, not only does it help global health, but it also helps the environment. And that's because, you know, as we know, things like beef, things like animal meats have a very high environmental burden. So, you know, a beef burger on average requires around about 35,000 litres of water to produce and produces a lot of carbon.
When you only account for the emissions that go into the processing, transportation, packaging and selling of a food product, the difference between these foods isn't so great. When you add the emissions from growing and processing food for livestock, you can see that animal products have higher emissions than vegetables. But the real gap comes from these two factors: the emissions associated with the farming process and the impact of land use change. Coffee has such a big footprint because of the fertilizers farmers use to grow it, which emit a lot of the greenhouse gas nitrous oxide. The farming process also accounts for most of the disparity between cow and sheep products and everything else.
Again, all of these begin to tie into each other, and likewise, a lot of the waste that comes from the system is the fact that the more processing that a basic crop requires, the more waste you're going to see. So again, by changing diets, we also help reduce waste and emissions. But again, that's going to be regulation. And we kind of mentioned, you know, to take one example, the UK in April is bringing in a new tax on any company that's producing a plastic product that doesn't contain at least 30% non-virgin plastic. So it's really creating this circular system and a system that overall is producing a lot less physical waste.
More food created with greater efficiency, a drastic change to our diets, and a huge reduction in the amount of physical and natural waste are the three changes Felix says are needed to prevent a disaster. But with change comes opportunity, particularly for investors. So where do the opportunities lie, starting in agriculture?
So, you know, when we talk about opportunities in agriculture, one of the things that we really look for is this kind of capital reallocation. And I think we've mentioned that, you know, across the whole system in food and water, it's estimated that around $30 trillion needs to be spent. And just in the farming element alone, it's estimated that about $9.1 trillion $1 trillion needs to be spent. So this is a massive uptick versus current spending levels. And really, that's going to create opportunities across the value chain, because it's going to benefit the companies that are creating products and services that allow us to become a lot more efficient, both from a carbon perspective, a water perspective, and also an application perspective, which ultimately helps biodiversity. And so, we get very excited, because this isn't just about one part of the system that's changing. This is about a long-term structural shift with large-scale capital reallocation.
But the change in the way we farm and produce food will matter little unless we change our consumption habits. And that's where the opportunity lies in food choice.
So regarding the food choice opportunity, one of the things that we talk about and one of the kind of central structural shifts that we see is actually a change in diet. So, you know, this isn't just about changing how we make the food we consume. It's also about changing what we're consuming. I think I mentioned earlier that, you know, the meat industry is quite a clear example of this, because at the moment it accounts for almost half of all greenhouse gas emissions from the agricultural system. And, you know, as I'm sure a lot of people are now aware, there's a lot of alternative products coming out, be that things like the Impossible Burger, Beyond Meat Burger, so the kind of fake meats that are coming out.
One of the biggest shakeups in the food world and the technology world over the past 5 or so years is the popularization of plant-based meat. And one of the most famous companies doing it is Impossible.
One of these is not a hamburger. This one was created in a lab. It's called the Impossible Burger, and it's 100% made from plants. But unlike your typical veggie burger, this is bloody and red, and it cooks and tastes like an actual beef patty. And several U.S. chefs have already put it on their menus. But the big difference between this and a veggie burger? Scientists made it using neuroscience.
In October of this year, Impossible Foods finally released their line of plant-based ground meat in grocery stores across America. And they just pulled off a huge deal with Burger King to start using their product in their world-famous Whopper. Check out this commercial from Burger King.
The stats on those are pretty astounding in terms of the environmental credentials. So a Beyond Meat burger produces around 97% less greenhouse gas emissions, uses 99% less land, and uses about 96% less water. So much, much better for the environment. There are still, you know, nutritional hurdles that need to be overcome. And what's interesting as well is actually we're now seeing things like cultured meat, which, you know, a couple of years ago was almost in the realms of sci-fi.
Cultured meat is made from the stem cells of animals, which are collected and then taken to a lab where they are fed nutrients in order to grow into living tissues. And we've already seen businesses such as Future Meat Technologies raise millions of dollars from investors. And the company opened the first industrial cultured meat facility in June 2021.
It's now expected that these will become economic in the next 5 years. So we're seeing a lot of products that are coming out, and we're seeing a lot of the large companies that are already in this space, you know, the household names that we're familiar with, really starting to invest pretty majorly into these products, because they're aware that this is no longer just a fad or a trend that is only being taken up by people who are going vegan or vegetarian for either the taste or for animal welfare. This is now also an environmental part of the equation. So we're seeing a lot of new products with much better environmental credentials, because actually that's what the consumer is wanting. So again, the consumer here is going to be a huge driver of this. When we look at how this plays out, at the moment, the meat industry is about a $1.7 trillion industry, and the alternative protein industry within that is only about $2.2 billion. So it's a fraction. It's less than 1%. And actually, we and a lot of people in the market think that this could get to around 10% by 2030. And some people are now saying that, you know, cultured meat could reach 60% of the market by 2040. So there's huge change, huge opportunity, and a lot of opportunity for actually the companies that are already in this space, but also those that are coming to market with a differentiated product that is either healthier or has better environmental credentials.
And if we change our food choices, it will in turn create opportunities in waste and emissions reduction. Here's Mark Lacey.
The emissions are really the bit that's really misunderstood globally. And because when a lot of people focus on emissions, they focus on, you know, transportation sector globally or the power production sector globally, which make up about 52% of emissions. The food and water system is responsible for about 26% of greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, whether it's in livestock, which is a very common one, obviously with regard to methane, or even in crop production or land use, and even the supply chain, when you break up these individual percentages, it's across those individual areas which they need to be at a lot more efficient. So whether it's technologies in livestock, for example, which is feed additives, which are basically introduced to basically reduce methane emissions, that's one technology. With regard to supply chain, it works very, very closely with the transportation system, i.e. looking at basically low carbon emitting methods of basically transporting these goods globally. And land use, obviously, you've got companies now which are basically looking at moving away from internal combustion engine methods of farming to use more electrified uses of farming as well in terms of the technologies. So the opportunity for the food and water system to basically reduce the emissions is really visible for us to see at this point in time.
So the opportunities are potentially huge, with around $30 trillion of investment needed to turn around the tanker that is the food and water system. But how do investors access those opportunities? That's coming up in the final part of the show.
So when we think about investment opportunity, we have to step back. We're looking at basically where an industry is going through a huge amount of change, but at the same time, where there is a huge amount of capital driving that change. Felix has already mentioned the $30 trillion, which is needed to be spent between now and 2050, which is a significant step change in the investment rates across all parts of the value chain, whether it's producing effectively food products, whether it's basically storing and transporting those food products, whether it's methodologies and technologies that's applied to that part of the industry, and then whether it's also with regard to distribution, at the same time while addressing the issues of pollution and waste in particular, and obviously scarcity and availability. Now, what we're seeing with regard to this industry is a huge amount of these companies employing brand new technologies, which require a bit of initial investment in order to basically deal with those major challenges. And what we're seeing is a lot of these companies go from effectively low growth rate companies to higher growth rate companies. But at the same time, at the moment, they have a very much a value bias. A lot of these companies have very strong balance sheets. They generate a huge amount of free cash flow. And this is, we strongly believe, a lot of these industry players is because they've gone through such difficult times that they know how to basically run a business for free cash. And this change is a huge opportunity with management with this mindset.
Mark says the opportunity is akin to that presented in the energy transformation sector, where new technologies and ways of thinking are disrupting the sector and bringing about a cleaner focus to the way energy is produced and consumed. However, he says there's some major differences.
The same thing is happening in the food and water system, but we strongly believe that it's 2 to 3 years behind the energy transition sector, because government policy is really starting to address this need now, particularly as it's linked, as Felix has already said, you're starting to get huge disruption from a climate perspective on agricultural yields and the impact of the as a result on the consumer at the same time. The difference we would say this time, though, is rather than lots and lots of new entrants coming into what we consider across this value chain mature industries, it's the industry itself and it's the incumbents existing within that industry that are going through the change. And that's the major difference. These markets that are opening up are brand new, but it's the existing players in the traditional industries that are participating and are keen to drive the change in the industry. And there lies the investment opportunity.
I think, you know, Mark makes a very good point, and maybe just using one example, like a company like Deere. You know, Deere has reinvested around about, you know, $1 billion every year into their R&D. It is a company that's almost disrupting itself. And they've got a huge VC arm, a venture capital arm, that will basically be looking for these new up and coming companies that have an individual technology that they can then incorporate into their overall equipment offering. So again, unlike some of the oil and gas companies that really have had to be driven to this point by shareholders, by regulation, by government, and, you know, even in court cases in some instances, these companies seem to be looking ahead a little bit more and acting preemptively.
I think another major change as well is another major difference is that the consumer will have a very, very, very important role to play in the speed at which the system changes. When you look, just look at diet habits and the need for basic and the willingness to basically use products that, for example, have used recycled plastic, and the dietary change with regard to going from a meat-based burger to a meat-free burger, for example. There is already that willingness there. So the consumer take-up relative to the energy transition is likely to be a lot more faster because it's directly and accessible to the consumer. Whereas obviously within the energy transition, you can really only feel comfortable buying an electric vehicle when there is the suitable charging infrastructure in place and when the cost profile of the industry, it enables mass adoption of electric vehicles.
Opportunities for food and water lie within the industry and are being driven by changing consumer habits. But what happens if investors don't step up? What happens if we don't see that $30 trillion worth of investment?
Well, you know, if we do not change, you are going to see increasing negative feedback loops. I've mentioned that at a 2-degree warming scenario, corn yields, for example, fall by more than 20%. And actually, at the moment, we're on track more for about a 3.5-degree scenario based on the Schroeder's tracker. These are going to have huge impacts. And likewise, if we don't change, we're going to have to use more land for agriculture to feed the growing population. That results in more deforestation, that results in collapse in species, and actually an acceleration in climate change and global warming. We're going to see mass desertification of areas throughout Africa. That in turn will trigger food security crises, mass immigration. You can very quickly paint a picture of how this plays out. And, you know, ultimately, all of this could end up with a sort of mass hyperinflation of food, which is really a terrifying prospect.
If you don't feed people, you feed conflict. Conflict drives anger and famine, and anger and famine drive conflict. When a country or region...
And one that we haven't seen for generations. So... Again, I cannot overestimate how important this is, for the world to get right. So really, we can't afford not to act. But, you know, on a brighter note, we are seeing a lot of technologies and data applications coming through that are massively helping to boost yields. Things like gene editing and genetic modification are controversial in certain markets. But likewise, if that allows continents like Latin America to leapfrog some of the more developed agricultural markets and actually require less pesticide, lower amounts of fertilizer, all of this is going to have a huge positive impact. And likewise, you know, the consumer is central to this. And if our diets do even just moderate a little bit, we can have huge impacts on global greenhouse gas emissions through the sector. And finally, you know, the tangibility of physical waste, I think, isn't lost on anyone. And again, it is up to the consumer to make sure that they are recycling properly. But it is also up to the companies and companies that ultimately we think it's possible to invest in to come up with technologies that can actually turn the waste that is being produced by companies and countries and take that from being a burden that has to be got rid of in landfills to ultimately a revenue stream. Because it is mad that at the moment we spend billions of dollars producing new oil, with about 6-8% of that being used to generate plastic, when there is, you know, plastic clogging up our oceans. It is not a sensible equation, but we are seeing these changes. we're seeing consumers begin to care more and actually move with their wallets and vote, you know, vote with their feet in terms of how, you know, how they're spending their money within the food system. We're seeing governments wake up to this, and ultimately the technology is also improving the economics across the value chain.
And more importantly, we see the change at the company level. So the companies that are dominant in these industries already have a clear path to change, and they recognize these challenges. That's why it's so easy to paint a bleak picture, but when we speak to the companies that participate in these industries, and you look at the profitability of these companies while they're enabling this change, we're extremely optimistic. It's not all doom and gloom ahead of us, given we see the potential for these this industry to change so aggressively.
Here's what else investors are talking about. With around 80% of terrestrial biodiversity existing in forest, deforestation poses a critical threat, according to Catherine McCauley, a sustainable analyst at Schroders. It's also brought a broader impact on climate change, human rights, and even global health, as the COVID-19 pandemic has brought to light. If tropical deforestation were considered a country, it would be the third most polluting nation in terms of carbon emissions. So it's clear, deforestation is a big issue. You can read Catherine's Q&A, Why Tackle Harmful Deforestation and How, at schroders.com/insights, where you can read, watch and listen to much, much more. Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to find out more, check out our website, schroders.com/theinvestor download. You can also get in contact with us about anything in the show or ideas for future shows at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. Please remember to subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review. We're now doing one show a week, which will be available every Thursday from 5 p.m. UK time. Thanks very much for listening, but above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.